morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, whenever you are. Thank you for joining us. This is Asian Highway, Storytellers in Action. Thank you for joining us on AH1 today. We have a very exciting show today to talk with an actor who is in LA by way of New York. His name is Eugene Young. We're going to talk to him about some of the work he's done on stage, in front of the camera, and he's done some nonprofit work, which we really want to delve into. Before we get to him, I want to bring in my two co-hosts. I am Pimo, just so you know, and I have sitting next to me our good co-host Debesh, and across from me Medha, and we want to talk about the loss of our childhood.
Bum bum bum.
Yes, Toys R Us is no longer around, sadly. I don't want to grow up. I want to be a Toys R Us kid, but I guess we've grown up.
I guess we've had to. I have some thoughts about this because I, amongst our merry band of people here, I am actually a collector of collectibles and things of that nature. I've actually, as an adult, sold action figures and bought and had a side hustle doing that. I grew up going to Toys R Us, and the experience, and I'm sure many of us who grew up in that time could echo it, going into Toys R Us was a experience. It was like, for me, it was almost as good as going to like Disneyland, because you would walk in, you knew exactly the trail to go to get to where you wanted to go. You had to go through the bike section to get to like the Transformers and the G.I. Joes. And when your parents weren't looking, you would sneak away to the video game aisle. And interestingly, for security reasons, they used to have tags or slips for the video game. So if you wanted to buy a video game, you would take the slip, you would pay for the video game at the register, and then go to this nondiscreet section in the back with just a window.
I remember this.
You would submit the receipt with that tag to get the video game, which was really a 4-bit Atari 2600 cartridge, which is probably worth like nothing now, especially if it's the ET video game, but I'm not even going to get into that. The point is, though, is that it was an experience.
It was.
As I got older, as I started going there as an adult, obviously the times changed. But the issue is that with Toys R Us, that experience went away and they never really replaced it with anything. And for a long time, Toys R Us was the giant. I mean, they bought out FAO Schwartz, I think in the 90s sometimes, which is a huge toy retailer. And they never really did anything to innovate beyond that. They sort of just rested on their laurels. They got into a bad situation, got, you know, taken over by a company that was all about creating more debt to maximize the juice from that particular lemon. And here we are right now where Toys R Us is in this very precarious position where they're likely, you know, going to get liquidated. I mean, there are some stories out there about them maybe getting bought out by other company, and maybe some of the stores might stay open in the US and maybe the Canadian stores stay open. Interestingly, some of the stores in Asia, I think in Japan and,
Philippines.
And even in Philippines are like, hey man, we're good. I don't know how you guys are doing, but we're good. So
what lessons can we learn from, at least from a storytelling perspective? I mean, you know, we have a whole narrative here of not adjusting, and how significant is that from a standpoint of what we're trying to achieve here with this podcast?
Keep up with the times. Blockbuster.
And as cliche as that sounds, 101. I mean, right?
But interestingly, there is a Blockbuster video in Alaska somewhere. So I would like to like our listeners to, if you know where it is, please tweet at us and let us know.
For the record, I ain't going to Alaska because I got to stop wearing flip-flops if I go up there.
Oh, you can. You might just lose your feet.
Tower Records.
Still in Japan.
Right.
Still in Japan.
But interestingly, to bring this back, though, the way that experiences and entities evolve is by telling the story, hearing the story, and evolving their story
right
through action.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, we'd like to ask our guest throughout the course of this podcast about his evolution. So, let's reintroduce Eugene Young. He is in LA, but he's come here by way of New York. He's done some stage work. He's done some on screen work. He's got a great educational element that he works with. We're going to ask him all about it in a minute. So let's welcome our seventh guest of the season here, Eugene Young. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys very much. It's great to be here. I just want to jump in on this Toys R Us thing.
Please, sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're a Toys R Us kid too, man. Yeah, no problem.
Absolutely. I mean, what you're saying about in the experience, right? I mean, I don't know about your families, but for us, it wasn't a surprise, the gift we got. No, we went with our moms and picked out.
Yeah, I want that.
What's funny about it is it wasn't just, I want that. You know, we my mom and my dad, you know, had limited means, or they acted like they had limited means. Sure. So it was a negotiation. I was like, could I get that? Or mm-hmm. like, and so this experience of, on my end, it was just like, definitely walking to the store was the most amazing thing, because they had everything. Right. They didn't even have video games. They had bikes. Yeah. You know, and they had like those like Tonka things and those crazy, like, you know, and just, it went, it escalated. And you knew as a kid, well, I can get away with this, or like, I would like that. And for the parents too, you could see your kid and like the joy of it, versus right now, you know, you order something that you assume your kid wants. It comes in a box and then you just open it.
Yeah.
There was something that's very sad about the end of that whole process of getting a gift, and you know.
And you know what they say, that the journey matters more than the destination, right?
I don't even remember what I used to get, but I remember going to Toys R Us. I remember one time my mom, she was excited too. She left her handbag in a Toys R Us cart and it was stolen, you know, and that was like the big story that year. And I don't remember what the gift that I got was, but I learned some like street lessons going to that
Toys R Us. I hope it was worth the handbag.
In Woodside, Queens. Yeah.
Yeah, but. Well, let's talk more about the kid in you, and I'll hand it off to Dibesh to start some more questions here.
So obviously, Eugene, you work in front of the camera, you work in front of audiences, mm-hmm. you play all these different roles, all these different characters. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we want to ask you right from the get-go, who is Eugene Young outside of these parts and roles and characters that he plays?
That's a good question. I think, you know, playing these roles and things, I think it informs who we are, because I think at a level, a lot of actors, we are still wanting to play make-believe. We're still wanting to play in the backyard with nothing and make something and play these things that we're not. And I think what's exciting about acting is if you stay in and you can sort of sustain a career, you actually learn a lot about yourself. I think I'm a more eloquent, more brave, more sociable, you know, better at the bar with the ladies, you know? But just like you learn these because you have to show the best. Often you have to show your best self.
Right.
But when you do interesting work, you get to show a worse self, or a side, or a tangent, or a stretch that you, if you really go for it, you get to sort of push and pull as to who your identity is. And so what's really thrilling about it, at the best, I mean, there's a lot of things about acting that are not fun, and the TV business and the theater business that are not fun, but you kind of get to figure who you are, because, you know, I'm from New York, you know, I'm in LA now, more for work here, but I was a shy kid as a kid, but I also was exposed to a lot of sort of opportunities at a young age in the business. And so over time, over reps, I feel like I've been able to sort of explore, you know, what the best version of myself is. And I think that's continuing. That's kind of an exciting thing.
I want to delve into now acting as a platform, and we see it also in sports, but, you know, one thing actors and athletes have is the power of a platform.
Yeah.
You know, and we kind of saw this play out with sports, with, you know, the kneeling during the anthem, and, you know, you have commentators saying only stick to dribbling, and, but, you know, if you have a following and you have a platform, you have a means to say something, despite people saying, oh, you know, it makes me uncomfortable, so don't say it. Is it a factor of, if people tell you, hey, stick to acting, don't say anything, is that you losing your voice? And how important is it to have your platform as a means to make the world better if you can?
I mean, that's a great question, because that's hitting a lot of athletes, and you see it a lot in Asian American actors who are being more increasingly vocal. Mm-hmm. I think before, we're talking 2 years ago, we didn't have people who were at the level who could say something and be heard.
Right.
But now, it's what the things that are saying are biting, you know, our stars, our leaders in our industry, you know, we're talking about Constance Wu, Daniel Day Kim, they're no longer afraid, even though for me, I'm like, wow, that is really bold, because, you know, they have other places to go in their career. You know, they're sort of, they're on their way to more power and more influence, and like to sort of maybe squash that before. But, you know, we live in an age where you having an Instagram or a Twitter and regularly communicating, that is political in itself, you know, the sort of messages you send, the pictures, the faces, the colors you see, and I'm talking about whether it's really filters or the colors of people's faces, you know, that is inherently political. And I think that not only is it more accepted, it's also kind of expected, you know, like it's hard. Like, now you have this like whole backlash over, like, this is a different industry, but like Taylor Swift, who's not taking a stand about her fans, you know, like there is some maybe, conservative elements or whatever. And she's sort of playing it down the middle. And that makes a bunch of her fans anxious too, because like now it's almost expected that you have to be in these times that we live in that are so political, that you actually have to. Realness is taking some kind of stand or some kind of opinion rather than just taking the Safeway and nothing at all.
Right. Know? We've come a long way from like Michael Jordan, where Republicans buy sneakers too, and Charles Barkley, I'm not a role model. I mean,
that was only Charles Barkley has changed himself too. I mean, he was on stage with Doug Jones. And, I mean, the way that the narrative was, you know, like he got a lot of the lion's share's credit. You know, he got that big interview on CNN afterwards, you know, and like, and this is Mr. Barkley, who's like, I'm not a role model.
We were talking, Veda, evolution.
Yes.
Keeping up the times, right?
Yeah.
Right. Toys R Us evolve. So Eugene, you know, part of your background is that you have, you know, a lot of great education. You have all these degrees, accolades. And we live in a time where there's almost this seemingly race to the bottom where, you know, having all these accolades, you know, academic accolades is almost, you know, a bad thing, you know, almost a liability. So, when you encounter other people, how do you kind of get beyond the, oh, I'm more than just my degrees and things like that, where you're able to kind of, you know, dispel these notions that, you know, this elitist sort of, oh, I'm this educated elitist person, and you kind of are able to connect with people?
That's really interesting. I don't know if I have an answer to that, but I do know, like, in the way with time and with age, that changes. I think that, you know, I came from a sort of elite public school in New York City that you had to test to get into, and I went to an Ivy League school. And earlier in my life, like, that meant a lot, you know, like we would ask each other, oh yeah, what school did you go to? You know, like, and also, to be honest, because I was doing a non-traditional route, where all my friends were bankers, and lawyers, and like to this day are bankers and lawyers. It was a weird thing where that I was almost putting that on my sleeve to let people know, hey man, I'm not just like an uninvited guest here. You know, like I know the people here.
I got cred.
Yeah, I got cred. But it's weird in our business where it's actually, it's kind of not worth a lot. You know, like people who say there is some pride that comes from, you know, if you graduate out of Yale, sort of Juilliard, the sort of gold standards of acting and stuff like that. But a lot of those people, you know, they enter the same sort of big pond business, like tough sort of sharky waters that everyone enters. And over time, people talk less about that. I mean, I'm sure they have internal pride, and there is sort of that mafia of, like, especially in theater, where a lot of people who work are from Yale and stuff like that. But it's not something that people say. And it's increasingly gotten more democratic, where there is a lot of more DIY in everything, right? DIY media, right? Whether it comes from movies or learning how to act. Like I haven't really taken an acting class. I just sort of learned it through the jobs and sort of a lot of auditions and a lot of readings, a lot of reading and stuff like that. And so we're no longer in the age where because you got that degree, then you get to do the thing. And that's increasing in all media levels, you know? And like, look at this podcast, you know, you guys we had the technology and this sort of social influence to create something and then have people listen.
We didn't all go to radio school.
Well, I see all these fancy degrees that these guys made. It looks like they photocopied, you know, they have a Harvard with an H-A-H-V-E-R-D. I don't know what that means, but they've placed it pretty prominently here.
Someone went to comedy school here.
Well, and to your point, I mean, I brought that up in previous episodes where, I mean, my education is nowhere. I'm a journalist.
Yeah.
I went to law school. Yeah. I studied politics, and I am now a journalist. I'm not doing anything at all what I studied. So it's a case for all of us.
Yeah,
here. We all
same
have that,
here. Like I went to medical school, and then I did a I have graduate level education and other things. But here I am.
And I went to film school, somewhat related.
A little bit.
I noticed that more and more with people in our business, where people have had second careers, and people sort of. Our generation is slightly older, whereas when I was coming up and asking, you know, I thought I was going to be a lawyer, so I would ask. And I actually thought I was going to be a journalist, too, because I sort of did a lot of that in high school. And they were always like, you have to pick wisely because you get one shot. This is like your career forever. So, like, you're a lawyer, you're a lawyer. And so we're able to now wear multiple hats and have side hobbies and have side gigs and see that, hey, you know what? I have talents here, or have a path, you know, or have like-minded people to sort of work with. How lucky we are that we're not, you know, sort of stuck in that, you know, that one degree, that one destiny kind of thing. And, you know, with our parents and stuff like that, you know, just the luxury we have to, like, sort of wear a different mask, you know? Trying to relate it back to acting, but, like, be a different character. Be this side version of you, you know, same, but doing something different, trying something different.
Well, there's a little, before we get the next question, a little big data stat for you. There's actually, and I'm not the biggest big data fan out there, but there's a stat that the average American goes through three career changes over their life,
right?
On average.
That is accurate. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it happens more often than we realize sometimes that you're not just making one choice. You know, you're going to make changes because we evolve over life, right? Just to bring it back to the point we talked about earlier, there's, we all go through evolutions and, you know, just because we were at one point and a teenager doesn't mean we're going to be the same point when we're 40s.
Right.
And I think that's not always necessarily publicized. Like when we're making that transition, we're not, I mean, we have social media now to make that announcement, but I don't know that we necessarily say, hey guys, this is what I was doing, but now I'm moving into this.
Right. So. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you're truly going to do that next thing, then, you know, maybe you don't need to have that statement, that prerequisite statement.
Yeah.
I am this, what I am now. This is what I am. You know? And if you know me, you know I'm changing. And so you know that, you know, I also sell hot dogs or that's what I do, but you know.
Talking about being a multifaceted, multi-skilled individual, you're very involved with a group called the Jeffrey Foundation.
Yes.
And what's the model? How does it work? How can people be involved with it?
So I came upon them happenstance. They're this great sort of community organization who's been in LA for 45 years. They were just like two blocks away from my house. For 2 years, I just drove by. I didn't know what it was. It looked like a preschool. But they have this great story where the founder had a special needs son. And she had to quit her job because there was no way to take care of him and have a job.
Wow.
And her and her husband actually divorced because of the conflict over, his name was Jeffrey. And so she quit her, you know, her job and went full time into creating a nonprofit organization or philanthropy that works with special need kids in early education. So we're talking about pre-K, you know, kids with learning disabilities. So, you know, obviously the ADHD, but there were kids who, you know, who might spit a lot, you know, they just can't, or they pull on kids' hair constantly, or, you know, or, you know, they run away from the school, you know, things that are like very outside of our 30 kids in a classroom public school model. And so over these years, she's grown this to multiple schools and stuff like that, where, you know, you get to work with these kids. And, you know, I go, sometimes I go twice a week, sometimes I go three times a week, but obviously I'm one of the fewer male volunteers, and so there are a lot of great trained sort of female teachers and stuff like that. But I get to, you know, play with them in the yard and sort of be a male influence and whatever that is, you know. But it's great for me. I get to just play ball and, like, you know, throw the football at these, you know, kids as hard as I can, you know, and just peg them in the head.
You get to be a Toys R Us kid, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, and you know what I have to say? I remember as a kid, and when I went to pre-K, English was like my second language. And so I remember us for like sports, we would go to a gym and we'd all wait in line with one tricycle that would go around the entire gym. And you just wait online until that tricycle went around and then it was your turn. You got to do one lap.
Wow.
At the Jeffrey Foundation, the amount of toys, they have like magnetic fishing rods that have like fishes that have magnetic lips that pick up things like that.
They have
these cool unicycles and tricycles, and I'm always riding and I ride really fast. And then sometimes the kid falls and I pick them up real quick and I dust them off.
That's great.
But it's so amazing. I mean, over there, I think the ratio, I mean, because there are volunteers and stuff like that, but the ratio is something incredible. Like, I don't even like 5-1, 4-1, like, you know, sometimes Jumpstart, a national organization, they send their volunteers there to help, you know, read with the kids, but they have a better preschool experience than I did, you know? And I turned all right, and I think they're going to turn all right. And it's just been a really sort of awesome local organization that I would have never, you know, looked up, you know? But as I increasingly worked with them, I've just found great joy in getting to, you know, wake up, drink my coffee, like I skateboard over there.
Nice.
You know, it's really cool. You know, it's really, really cool.
What have you learned personally through your experience of working with them and, you know, seeing the world through the lens of these children?
And what
incentivizes you to keep going back? I mean, apart from being in Toys R Us for the rest of time.
Yeah. You know what's really cool? I mean, it was really cool to see the kids how in the beginning, we all use our pre-biases and our preconceptions. And, you know, I walked in there, I'm like, oh, those are the problem kids. Those are the kids that have serious problems. And these kids are nice, you know? And I remember there's one, and if weirdly enough, I think he was Korean. He's an Asian kid who would just cry all the time unless you only paid attention to him. And this drove me nuts. So I was just like, come on, you know, like you want to be so babysat. Like all the kids need attention and you just want to. So I would run around, like try to run away from him. Literally the opposite, like opposite tag. Like, you know,
this is after you dusted him off, right?
Yeah. But, no, and what ended up happening was he was just crying so much for his mommy because he would just wait to the door until his mom came. And all of us who provided them maternal infants, where we would hang out with him, and he would just hold our hand, then he wouldn't cry for a second. But the second you had to go attend to another kid, he would cry. Over time, though, after week, that kid became one of the most self-reliant, sort of happy, just played with himself. You know, he's still very bad at sharing with toys with other kids, but like the change. And so that made me realize, wow, you know, like people, you know, kids, you know, they aren't these, this kid is, this kid. No, it's a malleable thing that changes with time, the development and stuff like that. And like, it's when, you know, in TV, you're like, the bad guy is the bad guy on TV, or like the problem kid is the problem kid, you know, like, okay, if you have a movie about one character as the main character, then that character might change. So I guess I may be fixed into these ideas of like, that is that, labels are labels, you know. It's so amazing to see growth in kids, and I just think that's the most amazing thing. And you know, yeah, he's one of the best kids there. Like, you know,
and
it's
just
really
for
amazing.
Other parents, how did you transform this child?
You know what it is? It's just more and more time that he spends. And I'm not a doctor or play a doctor yet. but like the more time that he spent where he realized that, you know, at the end of the day, his mom is going to come. And you know what? If you, these people who are there consistently, who we were there consistently, that he can depend on and know that, you know, that there is sort of no chaos, and that the way we treat him and others, you know, we're very big about if someone, a kid hits someone or trips someone, we bring them together, and then we're like, this is what happened. This is what happened. Do you agree? And do you apologize? And we make him apologize so that the rules are the same, you know, like, for example, this kid, he still has a problem with sharing. And so I'm totally okay with taking the ball away from him or taking the bike away from him and making him cry. Like, we need to remake him cry, you know, just sort of. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's no secret to parenting. I think parenting is attention, love, you know, sort of support, you know, and understanding.
Consistency,
you know,
it
and consistency.
Like, too.
Yeah, consistency, absolutely. I mean, our parents, you know, like, maybe they weren't home a lot, but we knew that, you know, they were sort of providing for us and like, you know, making sure we did well and beating us into doing very well.
Incidentally, there are a lot of adults that are not also good at sharing. So I won't fault the kid on that. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a process. It's a learning
experience. I tried to reach for your water bottle and you slapped it. Just like, no water for you.
Germs, cooties, man.
Yeah. So Eugene, I'm going to deviate here slightly because you touched upon something that made me think of another question. You know, we're talking about evolution so far, but, you know, individual evolving. But it sounds like there's also another word I want to use here is metaphor. Because it sounds like the story you had with this child is also a metaphor for bigger and better things, like how we could interact with other people at our own age. I mean, it's one thing to talk about how to interact with kids, but now we're interacting with people who have their own little quirks or positions and what have you. So how is your interaction with this kid a metaphor for how we should interact with our fellow humans?
You know, and the I'm going to have to pose a question on top of that. You know, how do we do that when we are interacting with less humans, you know, less people, you know, like, I want to work through stuff where, you know, I wish I could go back to school just so I can interact with people more and revisit those social skills that are now sort of concrete. We live in an age now where some of my closest friends, the way I check in on them is by stalking them on Facebook, on Instagram, or like, you know, no, I mean, just going to the bar and like seeing them, or seeing them in sort of fixed social situations. Sure. Like, I know that I will see them and we will get a couple of beers and it'll be like good times, you know? If we're not part of these organizations, community organizations, or sort of things that we have sort of hobbies and, you know, we're committed to groups of people, then we don't get to do that, you know? Sure. And increasingly, I think that question is about how it's tougher to do that. Mm-hmm. A lot of our friends are our friends. A lot of our partners are our partners, you know, and those relationships, we work on them, but there's very little room for the idea of sort of starting afresh, starting that new character. Once again, kind of going into acting and stuff like that. What is that reset where, you know, I'll take a person at face value and then let's just start again. That's harder when our relationships are sort of ingrained and, you know, already preset. And it's so unfortunate that, you know, some of my interaction is just through technology and sort of, it's increasingly less.
Sure,
you know, it's increasingly less. I have opinions. I read New York Times obsessively, but like, you know, like my vision of what a person who has different views from me is fixed on this internet, you know, sort of visage image.
Right,
you know,
right.
I haven't even talked to them. I haven't met them.
You know? It's something I like to call the come at me bro syndrome, you know? It's come like you have bro. People, everyone has an opinion and they're very open to share it on the internet, which is good and well, but, you know, a lot of people don't have that discussion and it becomes more of a come at me bro versus, hey, let's talk about this.
Yeah.
Let's also phrase this now in the context of your career.
Yeah.
You know, there is a narrative out there, whether you want to give it merit or not, of actors out of touch reality and, you know, you don't have much in common with the rest of the world. I mean, you know, we hear people say this, especially a lot nowadays. So I'm just curious, what's the struggle for you as an actor? Not so much, you know, in the audition room, but also just the struggle of being looked at as more than just an out of touch actor. And how do you relate to people despite whatever images or perceptions they have of you being an actor?
Right. I think, so I just did a show in New York where, we did maybe like 60 shows. It was like 8 shows a week and you met a lot of people who, you know, the cast would often go eat dinner at the same restaurant and go to a bar at this French restaurant. And we would meet a lot of people and I would also meet a lot of friends who knew of me, you know, going back to high school. I went to a high school that was like, I think now it's something like 70% Asian. Back then it was like 41%. We went to a huge high school. There's 750 kids a grade. So, you know, I have a lot of these Asian friends would come up to me and be like, yeah, we had heard you were still acting. And like, that's, you know, and sort of the conversation is like, you know, like, what is it like being famous or something like that? You know, like they don't even know, you know, it's just a really awkward question. And it's because I'm not famous, you know, and like, you know, let me Google that for you and I'll tell you. I don't know. But the terms of that is not, you know, like it's weird, right? You know, when someone does something like a profession where it's a musician or, you know, an artist or, you know, anything that really involves storytelling, I think people are like, whoa, that is such a cool thing. And I whether I'm nervous or like, I don't even understand that. I don't know how to interact with you, you know? And so I think what it is you do the opposite. You act like a real person, you know, you treat them, you know, whereas I could see where, you know, if you were famous, you wouldn't treat people with respect or with sort of, you know, that sort of, you're a person, I'm a person, but I think the more you do it and you realize, you know, whether it's a sense of humor or sort of, you know, you make fun of yourself or stuff like that, but like any business we're doing, we're trying to get better at it and it has its own pitfalls and it has its own sort of like, sort of glamorous aspects, you know, some like benefits, you know, like I wish I was an athlete, you know, I wish I was a hit podcast, you know, podcast dude, you know, number one on the New York Times. I wish, I'm sure there's some great benefits, you know, there's probably a lot of like, you know, podcast groupies just waiting outside the studio door, you know,
they are waiting. We actually hired them about an hour ago before you walked in.
That looked really impressive.
No, we're all very respectable people. None of those things has happened, but this would play to your skill of being an improved ladies man, like you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. You just try to, not that I'm trying to disarm, but you know, like I'm in New York, it snowed like every day, it was freezing. I've gotten very used to being in LA and there was weekends where we did 5 shows in a weekend, you know, and like, I had to take a fall as well as fire a gun during the show. And so like ears would be ringing and like my body, it got to the point where actually they had to hire a physical therapist for me. I was just, my body was a little broken, but, there's glamorous aspects and not glamorous aspects. And like, you know, with people, you just sort of let them know about that.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's just a job.
I went through the same thing when I used to be a sports writer and I've covered the Lakers. I've covered the Dodgers. I've interviewed Kobe and it's like, you know, people think, oh my God, you were in the Laker locker room? I'm like, yeah, but it's just whatever. Yeah. Like,
and it's really smelly.
Right. And that's
a lot of sweaty men.
And you'll be surprised when you start telling people the nitty gritty of what happens in the locker room. You're like, oh yeah, I don't want to be in there now.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh yeah.
Very
okay,
unglamorous.
So now you know what I go through. It isn't all that great, right? So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. And then they're like, oh. And then they turn to someone else and they talk to someone else.
Yeah, right.
So what degrees do you have?
Well, talking about a rather glamorous side of you, you are also very much into music. The theme of our season, season is music, and you're an opera singer. We've karaoke together. You're a far better singer than me, for sure. But
Wait, can we hear you both sing while we're here?
That would be great.
Yeah.
I had a few drinks and
a duet.
It was my birthday and we sang Whitney Houston. He was better than me.
Wow.
Much better.
I had a much higher voice than she.
Yes. Actually, you were a soprano, weren't you?
When I was a kid, I actually sang at Lincoln Center. I sang opera. At Lincoln Center. So I did it at the New York State Theater and the Metropolitan Opera. But yeah, my voice was like 5 octaves higher than it is right now.
Wow.
That is impressive.
That
is
like pre-puberty. Quite impressive. And it made no sense to it. So I was in La Boheme, and it was actually, it would go, every year PBS does a live opera, and it's almost always La Boheme. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was like the one Asian kid in France, and it like made no sense. And so they were just like justifying, he's like an adopted Chinese kid, which really, it made no sense. No one else in any of the adult parts were Asian. It just really made no sense.
So clearly music's an outlet for you, but is it also, do you use it as a way to storytell or share a point of view to people or somehow help the community in some way?
You know, I really wish I did more. I think music's a thing that in my busy life that I've sort of lost a little bit of track of. I used to listen to full albums and just be on top of sort of bands and stuff like that. So I get to audition for a lot of these musicals that go to, you know, NBC Live. So Peter Pan,
right.
Sound of Music, or whatever it is that NBC is kind of doing. Grease. I get to audition for them, you know, because I know I have a background and I have a good voice, but I'm just not in practice, because to be actually in musical theater requires even more training. And the sort of Broadway musical theater game is really hard. You have to be vocally strong. So you have to be constantly working with vocal coaches and just sort of be able to sing first off. But now you have to dance. Now you have to tumble. Mm-hmm. Now they want you to play an instrument too, because there's all these sort of like minimal choruses, and they also play an instrument on stage. That's the rage right now. And so to get in that game, it's all regional theater, right? You're performing in these great theaters in the rest of the country. And so, yeah, I mean, we have a problem in diversity in sort of Broadway and sort of musical theater. That's statistically a big problem. Some of my friends in New York are doing great work looking into that. It's hard. You know, I've focused sort of on comedy and sort of theater stuff, and I'm less in the sort of musical theater game, even though I do get my audition. I don't know if it's just because it's a diversity card and they have to bring some of us in.
Sure.
But I get to sing, you know, and audition for the musical every once
in a while. Okay. So let's finish off with what are you working on right now? What can you share? What any projects you're on? And where can people find out more about you and what have you?
Yeah. So, you know, right now I'm auditioning for the sort of the next thing. Yesterday you can see some of my work at youngeugene.com. It's just my name backwards, but it's youngeugene.com. Yeah, so I just finished the play in New York Cardinal that was with Anna Klumsky and Adam Pally that had a great run. And so I'm back in LA. So now I'm like, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
But yesterday, actually, I was in Maida's building on Gower, right? Isn't that mm-hmm. that's on Gower? So yeah. I was going to message you, but I realized I might see you today. But I got to meet Paul Feig and audition and improvise for him.
Oh,
for
cool.
Like, yeah. So for a show that he's doing. So right now for actors, this is like the period of, you know, I have a script right now that I'm looking at, but like we're all angling for the next job. So
sure.
Nice.
So that's where we're at.
Okay.
Know? Yeah.
And I have a random question. It's going to be hard for you to answer.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You'd mentioned English as your second language. What was your first?
It was Korean or, you know, actually I would say, you know, it was either Korean or the streets, you know, just the language of the streets.
I was going to say New York might be your first language.
Yeah.
New York.
Yeah, I would just have New to York. Run away and, you know, cower in fear just and communicate through.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where else can people find you? Is there a Twitter or a Facebook page?
Yeah. You know, try to stay away from the Facebook, but I am pretty active on Instagram, and that's at Eugeyoung. So that's Eugeyoung.
Okay.
My friends call me Huge. I don't know. It's very weird. Some of them... Yeah. But Eugene Young was taken. He's a dentist in Ohio.
Oh.
Eugene Young, DDS. So yeah, he has my sing. Yeah. I'm gonna have to buy that Instagram off of him when I get a little
more cash flow. Right. Well, thank you so much, Eugene. It's been a great line of conversation. We're glad to have you here. And just so you know, where here is, we're at Visual Communications in Little Tokyo. Big shout out to Marvin UF for helping us get through some great technical stuff here to get the show going. So thank you, Marvin, for all your great production work.
You're awesome.
Yes, he is. And you can also follow us. We're on Facebook.
Really?
Yes, we are. Asian Highway 1, right?
Live.
Asian Highway 1 Live. Yes. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle for both is the same. It's AH1 Live. And we're also somewhere else.
Yes, that's right. So if you want to hear this story and others, you can definitely find this podcast on iTunes, on Spotify, Google Play Music, and YouTube.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Be good, y'all.